Hey everybody, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And make sure my phone's on mute there. Yep. All right, today on the show, Rayford Davis is going to be on. I'm not sure if I should tell you who Rayford Davis is or if we should just wait and see. I'll tell you, there's a guy. That's his name. He's going to be on the show. I think you'll be interested to hear what he has to say. I think I am interested to hear what this guy's got to say. There you go. All right, now let me see here. I'm sending an email live at the beginning of the show, which is a pretty sloppy way to do it, but it is what it is. Ray's going to be on the show. Rayford Davis is going to be on the show. And Ray McGovern is going to be on the show. And Ray McGovern is going to be talking about, well, we're going to be talking about the Middle East. But you know what, too? I think also that, we're going to be talking about his lawsuit against Hillary Clinton and her goons. I love Ray McGovern, man. Isn't he great? I've gotten to meet him in person twice. Once at the, was it three times? No, it was just twice. Once at Camp Casey in 2005, protesting against George W. Bush. He has time to ride bikes with Lance Armstrong, but he's got no time for Cindy Sheehan. What'd she ever do for him? I mean, other than, you know, give him her son to use up. So, he didn't have the time of day for her. So, anyway, I was up there helping with the protest. Not helping, just protesting too. And Ray was there, and I got to meet him and hang out there. And, of course, I've interviewed him 100 times. And then also I met him in D.C., at the Council for the National Interest Foundation and the Institute for Research Middle East Policy and If Americans Knew and the Washington Report on Middle Eastern Affairs. They all held the... I got the DVD here. Here it is. It's called the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. If you want to watch me make a fool out of myself a couple of times and you want to see about 24 great speeches. Really, 24 great speeches, panel discussions, questions and answers from the audience. The National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. Ray was one of the speakers there, and that was in D.C. in March. And if you go to natsummit.org or go to Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, you'll be able to find out how to get a DVD copy of this thing. You can actually watch the whole thing online at... on YouTube, 8 hours long on YouTube, the whole thing, it's there. But I'd encourage you to buy the DVD, too, to help support, you know, anyway. But also, yeah, anyway, point being, I met Ray McGovern there again and got to hang out with him. He's a great guy. And he sued Hillary Clinton because, her goons, they broke the law. Anyway, I don't want to tell you too much more of the story unless you already know it, then in which case I don't need to tell you anyway. But so Ray's going to be on to talk about that. And then, of course, we're going to talk about substance, too. I don't want to just talk about that. I mean, it's important, but it's not as important as what we're, you know, really used to relying on Ray McGovern for. And that would be covering foreign policy. And, man, I guess you guys could probably hear that air conditioner blowing. I got to remember to turn that off at the break. God dang air conditioner. Usually I'm pretty good about remembering. In fact, I think this is the first time I didn't remember in quite a while. And I don't know if you can even hear it, but I can see on the bouncing green bars on my Adobe Audition that it's getting picked up there. So if you're wearing headphones, you can probably hear it. Not good enough. I need my noise floor to be down near somewhere around negative 60, or else I ain't happy. And in fact, I really wish I could get it down to negative 66. Somehow, or negative 70 something, but I just can't seem to get it below negative 60 digital decibels here. Save my life. Anyway, so that's the show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm a libertarian, and so I am against everything, and particularly American foreign policy. And so that's what I do here, mostly, is I try to debunk the lies that they tell to justify the actions that they carry out. You know, it's pretty easy because everything they say is a lie. So all I got to do is keep paying attention in a row. And it comes pretty natural. All right. So I don't even really know where to begin. There's so much here, but U.S. combat role in Iraq not off the table, says the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, contradicting the president again. Oh, no, this is from the 26. You know, McClatchy's morning email, they recycle old stuff in such a horrible way. Anyway, so that's the old fight. Obama has insisted that they're not sending ground troops. In fact, he said it again for the interview. I don't know the date that they recorded it, but he said it last night on 60 Minutes. He reiterated that they're not going to send ground troops. But I'll tell you what, too. I think it was just a Freudian slip. I think he made a Freudian slip in the way that he said it. He said, we're not going to be sending in the Marines. And Army soldiers. And so, maybe I'm too Kremlinologist-y here and I'm reading too much into it or trying to. It's just speculation about the man's language. But instead of saying, we're not sending the Army back there, he said Marines. And that, to me, is an indication that, they really have been talking about this. And if they're just sending anybody but trying to keep it at just, who are they going to send? They're going to send the Marines. And they need to attack a city like Fallujah in 2004. You send the Marines in there. They clear. Let the Army hold. But the clearing belongs to the Marines. And so the cliche would be, we're not sending the Army back there. But the actual substantive discussion of who we're sending would be more centered on the Marine Corps. That's why you've heard me say on this show for, almost the 10th month of the year? That's why you've been hearing me say on this show for the last 10 months straight that, yeah, they're going to have to send in the Marines to dislodge these guys at some point, this monster that they've created. So Obama, tried to pour cold water on that last night, but he only convinced me that it's a matter of time. John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, of course, is saying that ground troops are a necessity. There has to be boots on the ground. And he asks a question. If you accept the premise, which of course he doesn't challenge, you accept the premise that the United States must destroy the Islamic State, then yes, they do have to send in the Marines and the Army to do it. They say, oh, boots on the ground. It's got to be somebody else's boots on the ground. But whose? And I guess it's possible that the Kurds could take Mosul with American close and major air support. The Peshmerga could probably kick the Islamic State out of Mosul. But what if they decided to stay and fight instead of turn and run? I don't know. It might be very difficult. And of course, as you just heard in the top of the hour news, with air war comes civilian casualties, and with civilian casualties come more and more recruits for the other side. And so, here they're, what are they doing bombing a grain silo anyway? On the night they started this bombing in Syria, they said, we bombed, Islamic State headquarters. You bomb their headquarters? You think they have a headquarters? Who did they really bomb? Nobody even knows, but it certainly wasn't the headquarters of an organization that does not have a headquarters, for Christ's sake. Yes, we're bombing all their command and control facilities. No, man, that's the American Army you're describing. Command and control facility to the al-Nusra front or ISIS is a car driving down the road. What are we talking about here? Truck. Anyway, they're sending in more troops. At some point, they already have special forces. You're not supposed to count SOCOM, JSOC, CIA, or mercenaries at all, even though there are already thousands. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome to the show. Back to it, I mean. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003. At scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room. Hey, guys, how's things in there, man? It's scotthorton.org/chat. We got a few new guys who are like regulars now. Think AnCap Man is now, this is his third or fourth time in there, and a couple of others. So welcome to the new guys, and hey you again to the old guys. And that's all at scotthorton.org/chat. It's an IRC free node chat, so you can go to a plain old browser window, scotthorton.org/chat, or if you already have your chat program that you use for chatting on IRC free node chats, then just look for hashtag Scott Horton Show, and you're in. There you go. Fake name and a captcha and you're in. And I'm trying to pay attention more to that. And I should try to encourage you guys to ask questions of the guests, too. I don't know if I really have time to take callers for the guests. I don't know about that. But I could definitely take chat room questions for the guests if you guys want to chime in. I should encourage more participation in the show so as to make it more interesting, like, for you people who might want to participate in it. So, yeah. Coming up, Rayford Davis and Ray McGovern. You can ask them questions in the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Now, I got to say rest in peace to a couple of guys. First of all, Fred Bronfman. Now, Fred was a friend of this show for many years. I don't know, quite a few years. I guess it's been a while since I talked to him. And, you know, I actually considered a couple of times I wanted to interview him about this great essay that he wrote. The title is like Noam Chomsky Wept or some crap, some horrible title at Salon.com. It's actually this great essay about how he first met Noam Chomsky in Laos when they were trying to let the American people know that, hey, your government is mass murdering these people for no reason. And the carpet bombing on the Plain of Jars and all that stuff. So it turns out that, and I'm not the world's best expert on like anti-war movement history and particularly left-wing history and stuff. You know, I don't know. Eric Garris and Justin Armando both know a lot more about the left than I do. Although I don't know if either of them are really an expert on these three, but it seems to me from my point of view, the best I can tell, that Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, and Fred Bronfman, they were kind of like a certain little club of left-wing, prominent intellectual, very left-wing anti-war activists. And so I interviewed Howard Zinn once or twice before he died. And, he's better. He was more consistent than Chomsky on being really an anarchist, really a non-aggression principle guy, even though he was basically a communist. He was, he didn't want communism to work if it needed coercion to make it work, kind of thing. So he was much more consistently anti-government, Howard Zinn, than Noam Chomsky, for example. But anyway, and then Fred Bronfman, I guess I know not that much about his history other than what he wrote in that one essay. That's a very personal kind of story about him and Zinn and Chomsky there in Laos, the way I remember it. But anyway, I interviewed him a lot of times about his articles that I guess were mostly for the Huffington Post and whatever. And he was just really good on war. I can't think specifically. I didn't go back and check and read the summaries and try to remember what all we've talked about on the show. But I think I did interview him about Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia at some point, too. But anyway, the point isn't, about this show, but just here's a guy who for decades and decades dedicated himself to peace and, sticking up to innocent victims of his government. which, you know, I think is the right thing to do. And so, a life well lived. Fred Bronfman there. And then, Jim Trafficant. Now, Jim Trafficant, you know, I gotta say, I got a soft spot for the guy. I like him. Now, he is no Fred Bronfman. But then again, you know what? I think he's the only Democrat in all of Washington, D.C. who stuck up for the Branch Davidians. The only one who stuck up for the Branch Davidians. Because it was Bill and Hillary Clinton that had burned them all to death. Don't tell me that Janet Reno sent the Army Delta Force, top-tier special forces who work directly for the president, aren't even in the chain of command of the Army. Because they work directly for the president, not even the Secretary of Defense. Don't tell me Janet Reno sent them to kill the Branch Davidians. Bill Clinton did it. And so the Democrats thought, good, burn, ah. And it didn't matter that half of them were black. All the civil rights leaders, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, and are there any other civil rights leaders anymore? They didn't care. Because it was Bill Clinton that had sent the Army Delta Force to machine gun and burn them all to death. But Jim Trafficant stuck up for him. He also stuck up for innocent victims of the IRS. And for some reason, liberals are brainwashed, especially when Democrats are in power. They're absolutely brainwashed to imagine that only the very richest, whitest, business-owning Christian people that you don't like would ever be the victims of the IRS. Of course, the exact opposite is the truth. Those people have lawyers. Those people can fight back and save money by fighting back. That's not who the IRS goes after. It's the same fantasy about gun control. It's poor black people, the kind of people who you'd stick up for the civil rights of. They're the ones who go to jail on gun charges. Not the kind of people that you imagine in your little sociological fantasies with your stupid liberalism. Sorry. I'm already getting into the first interview of the day here. I mean to talk about Jim Trafficant. Jim Trafficant was, he was kind of corrupt, but only kind of. No more than the average congressman. And the only reason that the Justice Department prosecuted him is because he was an enemy of the state. And they were an enemy of his. Only they had the power and he was just some lousy congressman with no connections. And so they nailed him to the wall. They prosecuted him over and over again. Just over and over again. And what they convicted him on was like, he had a local contractor in town mend a fence on his farm. And then in payment, hardly anything. I forget. But it was stupid crap that every single member of Congress is guilty as hell of and all get away with. Not that I'm justifying it. I'm just pointing out why they prosecuted him. Because they didn't own him. And he is not a libertarian. He's a Democrat and he's screwed up in the head on a lot of things. But he was a brave guy and he was an anti-war guy and he was an anti-IRS guy and he stuck up for the Branch Davidians when nobody else did. Not a few years later, as Jesse Walker points out in Reason Magazine, not a few years later when everybody else decided, oh yeah, that was the FBI's fault or whatever, not Bill Clinton for sending the Delta Force to murder them all. But anyway, but no, when it counted, he tried to stick up for them even before they all had been killed, I believe. And then he ended up, after he got out of jail, only Jew-hating kooks wanted to hang out with him. So he started hanging out with them, which is unfortunate, and said some kind of stupid things. But he was a decent guy. He wasn't a hateful guy or anything. He was a decent guy, and he had a tractor accident and died, and it's sad. And so rest in peace, Jim Trafficant, dude. Thanks for sticking up for weak people. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, on Liberty Radio Network. Now, man, I have a whole cop section today. At the top of it is Rayford Davis and his blog, Blue Enmity. Huh, what an interesting name for a blog. Blue Enmity. It's at blueenmity.blogspot.com. Welcome to the show, Rayford. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Scott. It's glad you're having me here.
Very happy to have you here. Tell me, who are you?
I am a former police officer.
Former police officer from where?
I spent 6 years, 4 on patrol and 2 as detective with the city of North Charleston Police Department in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the 8th most dangerous city at the time I was there.
All right. Now, I'll tell the people the reason that you're on the show is because you emailed me and said, hey, I'm a former cop and I listen to your show and like it. It's not that you're stalking me, but you like it even though I say such horrible things about cops all the time. So, that piqued my interest and I read, almost all of this, essay here. Pretty much, yeah, I read it. This essay that you have at your, blog, I guess it's your first one about this shooting. And so, I guess, you know, I'm interested to know, how it is that anyone who was ever a cop, could have, you know, the slightest patience for a guy like me at all, even if you kind of got a different attitude about policing now. Palling around with Will Grigg is one thing, but I'm a hater. Come on, Rayford.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. It's really hard. I'm reminded of Upton Sinclair's quote. It's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding. Mm-hmm. And when you have you know, you're grown up with, hey, police are good and bad guys are bad, and it's when somebody comes and tells you different, that's very hard to accept. But certainly my experience as a police officer, you know, that's the conclusion that I came to based on my experiences there.
All right, and so. Now, you say that you conducted thousands of traffic stops. You were a cop for how long?
Well, 6 years. I mean,
6 years?
I was, nobody was special. I was just a normal cop. But you know, when you're on patrol, that's what you do is traffic stops. So
yep.
Make a couple a day, and they start adding up.
Yep. All right. And so, well, tell me, I guess, can you go back to what you really thought when you signed up, and what changed you? What made you? I mean, after 6 years, was it after 6 years, or it was earlier than that? That you, I guess, from the very beginning, you started learning the job was a bit different than you'd expected, or how's that work?
Well, sure. You know, I grew up, you know, reading the Constitution. You know, conservative, thinking, hey, you know. I know cops do maybe some bad things here and there, but you know, I'll be different and I can go in there and I didn't sign up to get honor and integrity or anything like that. I signed up to bring honor and integrity to law enforcement. I have a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. I thought I knew the law and had a good judgment. It didn't take long. I remember the first week I was there, out on patrol during training, and I watched one of our special enforcement teams that go through particular neighborhoods that need special interest, and they had pulled over some poor kid on a moped, probably for, you know, not having his turn signal on long enough or something like that, and had obtained consent to search his moped, and they're tearing this thing apart looking for marijuana or whatever. And this kid's not happy about it, but he, you know, really didn't have a choice. And I knew right there that, you know, this war on drugs just doesn't seem quite right. However, you know, drugs are bad, and you know, they do lots of harmful things. And when you don't understand the effects of what a black market is, and how actually when you make things illegal, that's what brings in the violence and the crime. And then you disenfranchise people from any type of dispute resolution. If you're a local drug dealer and you have a dispute, you have to use violence. You can't go to a court or something like that and say, hey, you know, this guy, you know, I've loaned him some product, and he didn't pay me for it. I mean, you have nothing to do but go straight to violence.
And now, obviously, you know, you're different than the average cop, but does the average cop understand that? Because it doesn't seem like it's that difficult, especially when you're living through the experience of it all the time and seeing how, you know, you make people outlaws and then they have to act like outlaws, like you say.
Right. You know, you do see it. And if you talk to cops, any cop about marijuana, oh, yeah, that's you know, we got to make that legal. But that's as far as I go. If you start questioning any more than that to say, hey, why are we messing with drugs at all? Why are we interfering with anyone's right to carry a weapon to defend themselves or anything like that? And then you question basically your entire reason for being there and everything you've ever been taught in your life. Mm-hmm. And that's very difficult to do.
In other words, they look at pot as just no big deal. It's like drinking a beer, so they don't care. But as long as we're talking about drugs that are actually bad for you, well, then those got to be illegal. Same basic, simplistic mindset without any thought to it.
Correct. And yeah. And when you don't understand, if you don't know, if you haven't read Murray Rothbard or Lou Rockwell or anybody else that talks about, hey, there's this thing called natural law and free markets. And when you try to change those by adding laws to ban substances and to interfere with people's normal exchanges, that's what brings the problems.
Yeah. Well, now, so it's interesting, you know, it's not that, I mean, I guess you weren't a detective out solving homicides or whatever. Like you say, you're basically a traffic cop out there pulling people over. But then every traffic violation becomes a drug war investigation. Basically, right? Some kind of fishing expedition.
Absolutely. They all do. I mean, certainly you have people out there, they're thieves and committing violence against others, but it's mainly the drugs and guns that, you know, that's what you're looking for. That's what every traffic stop, that's what you're doing. And that's what generates the violence is because people, they have a little bit of weed or, you know, a gram of cocaine or something that's, and that, they know, hey, I'm fixing to get arrested, probably going to go to jail. It's going to cost me thousands of dollars. And they're willing to resist or to flee because of that. And that is part of what I want to put out is, hey, that's what's making it so dangerous for the police as well.
Right. Yeah, I've told the story before. I talked to a childhood friend of mine after 25 years or something, and he was a D.C. cop. He said, I chased crackheads around all night. I said, oh, for crying out loud, you're the only reason they're running. Don't you know that you basically invented crack by outlawing cocaine use? I mean, what is this? This is really the life that you're living? I can't believe it. You know?
That's right. That's right. For people that, and law enforcement officers that don't understand it, I try to explain it to them. Asking a question, when is the last time you've seen two convenience store owners that sell beer and alcohol or two liquor distributors have a shootout? They don't do it. A fifth of whiskey is just as dangerous as cocaine and marijuana. But
all right, well, hold it right there, Rafer. We got to take this break. Everybody, we're talking with Rafer Davis. He's at blueenmity.blogspot.com. He's a former cop. We're talking about the way things are now. ScottHorton.org. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day, is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal, as we knew it, is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Talking with Rafer Davis, former cop from Charleston, South Carolina. And we're talking about the way things are now. The futility of the war on drugs and the destruction of American liberty that comes hand in hand with it. The cops' unwillingness to understand the situation for what it is, because they have every incentive to not understand, of course. Although everybody who's not a cop, pretty much, and the rest of society, that's maybe the most paranoid of and ill-informed of moms, are against the drug war. Now, hell, William F. Buckley from the National Review, the father of the new right from the 1950s, he came out against the war on drugs 25 years ago or something. Everybody who understands anything about economics at all, left, right, commie, libertarian, or anybody else, knows that it cannot work for anything but providing jobs for government employee union members. You know, that's basically what it's all about. But, you know, here's the other thing, and you mentioned this in your emails to me, Rayford, was the war on guns, too. And, of course, you got to be a libertarian to be good on both. For some reason, it's like a magical thing to understand the economics of gun control and drug control in the same kind of a way. And we seem to be in a situation here. I got a headline, 23 people killed by American police in the span of 1 week. And I don't know exactly. I assume most of those weren't armed at all, but maybe some of them had a gun, but they weren't necessarily doing anything with it. And it's such a contradiction. We live in a society where everybody knows guns are legal and there's some kind of concealed or open carry now in all 50 states. We got 300 million guns for 300 million Americans, although pretty much about 150 million Americans are the gun owners and the other 150 million not. But still, that's 300 million guns in private ownership circulating around in open markets, regulated ones, but legal markets in America. A small percentage of black market guns there. And yet the cops act like if anybody has a gun, kill them. If anybody has a gun, they're trying to kill you with it. You go home tonight. If they don't, tough. And so you see just over and over, just people, they'll say, well, he had a gun. But, you know, I've heard, and I'm no former soldier or anything like that, but I've heard soldiers and I've heard cops and I've heard people who were neither say, well, listen, unless I can see the barrel of a gun and they're really an imminent threat to me, I'm not shooting somebody, right? Like, that's the standard. Not someone may have a gun in their waistband. Not they were reaching into their car for what could have been something or something. When you see that barrel of the gun pointing at you, yeah, you gotta be a quick draw. But the alternative is you murder innocent people all day. And that's what we've got now, is a bunch of cops who somebody told them to expect that anybody with a gun is trying to kill them, even if the cops are breaking into their house in the middle of the night.
Well, you know what? I've had that gun and that barrel of that gun pointed at me, and it's a terrifying experience. You know, fortunately, I did not shoot anyone. I didn't have to, and I was able to survive the encounter. But it's the fact that the gun in possession is de facto legal. I know they have all these concealed carry laws and all of this, but cops still. You know, they basically treat anybody with a gun as it's somewhat illegal, and that's what makes the danger. Hey, we have this thing called the Second Amendment that's not to be infringed, but yet it's infringed, and you see that attitude increasing more and more. And this is coming from cops who are generally conservative, and they're, you know, hey, they're NRA, and you know. Don't take my gun from me. You'll pry it from my cold, dead hands. And then they go right a 10th Amendment Oath Keeper type guys. That's what they all are. And then they go right out and treat anybody with a gun like a criminal first and then lawful citizen later.
And especially racial minorities, too. There's just no way around it that, you know, I mean, in the New York Times, did you see a couple of months ago, they ran this article that I swear to God, I mean, the headline was, gee whiz, everybody, liberal do-gooder, Upper East or West Side or whatever it is, people in New York. I've only been there once. Well, look, did you know how sometimes black people aren't criminals? Well, guess what? Sometimes the black people who aren't criminals own guns and go shoot down at the range, and they're gun owners, and they're basically like white people who own guns. Like, that was the tone of the entire article. It was like, can you believe it that a black guy would own a gun, or a black woman even, for any reason other than to rob a store? Was like the whole New York Times article. It was like a Sunday weekend magazine piece. Jeez, look everyone, black gun owners. And if that's what the New York Times thinks, imagine what all the cops think, you know?
Well, you're right. You know, there's just very little individual racism, or, you know, I never saw any police officer, you know, just really be a racist. But two things. I would love to see the black gun owning community and, you know, like the NRA. That's two groups that I think could get together and really bridge this problem and get together on some issues.
Right. Yeah, you know, the ACLU is actually slowly but surely getting a little bit better on guns, because they're realizing that, like, this, their special report on the SWAT team raids, that, you know, the cops have this so-called matrix of the threat, and you get assigned a number. I guess you know it better than me. But if you're a gun owner, it doesn't matter whether you're just wanted for a bunch of old speeding tickets and they've never had any cause to think that you might be a threat to a cop in your whole life. Doesn't matter. If they're kicking in your door, that makes you a defensive threat against them, right? Like Iran is to the empire. Well, it's not fair for you to just sit there armed. And so, that's the way they look at it. And so, they include that information as a reason to raid people. Well, the ACLU looks at that and says, well, you know, geez, I'm not sure if that's fair, because after all, and they recognize there are a lot of law-abiding gun owners in America. Just because someone has a gun doesn't mean that they deserve to be executed by the law.
Certainly. You know, law enforcement does a terrible job of understanding that and say, hey, people are armed and they have a right to do so. And they just don't get
it. Yeah. All right. Now, so I wonder, too, about the training, because it seems like what we have here, and maybe it's a myth that there was ever really a doctrine of use the minimum amount of force for any given situation, because really your sacred duty is to protect the rights of the suspects of even the very worst crimes. You're there to protect them ostensibly from the lynch mob, to make sure they get a fair trial, that they're presumed innocent, and all these kinds of things, not to be the punishers out there going after people. You're supposed to be protecting our rights and using the minimum amount of force, and yet it seems like all cops in America, SWAT team or not, are trained on the Powell Doctrine, overwhelming force. If you have to cripple them, go ahead and break their spine if you want to, in order to neutralize any possible threat to you at any given time. So just... this is a big part of the shootings all the time, too. Is, you know, he looked at me funny. I had to do it.
There are bad guys out there, and, you know, you do anybody, even a private libertarian world security force, would want to protect themselves. What I want police officers to think is, when is it okay to use that force, to put yourself in the position where you need to use that force in the first place? You know, there's this thing beyond policy and procedures that you learn to train. There's things beyond the state law or the federal law or even the Supreme Court. There's things called natural law. And, you know, you can't use force against a person unless they use violence against you to begin with. And just carrying around a gun is not using violence.
Well, dealing drugs is kind of any old arrest. Whether are they really training the cops nowadays? You know, the new ones in the academy that, look, the people out there, they're animals. You're a soldier in the war against their barbarity, and so go out there and get them. Or are they taught at all about, like, hey, your job is protecting these people, so take it easy on them out there, or what? You know, and it seems like that would be the obvious training, the latter there.
Well, it goes back and forth. You know, certainly, I'm sure here locally, with that, you saw the police officer, the dash cam, in Columbia, where the state trooper, shot the guy when he asked him to go get his wallet, and he went and got it, and he thought it was a gun and shot him. And so, you know, everything will calm down for a little while. Hey, just last week though, I went to a funeral of a local police officer. He was shot and killed. He was responding to reports of a disturbance at an apartment complex. They go to knock on the door to see what's up, and the guy fired a rifle through the door and killed an officer and wounded another one. So they kind of go back and forth with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, still, it seems like, you know, the job is, and boy, it's starting at 80 grand or something here in Austin, Texas. So, you know, well, maybe that's part of the problem. It should be an underpaid job like a school teacher that, like, you know what, you do it because you really want to go out there and protect people. And you know that you're taking a risk and that you have to restrain yourself in a situation where you might want to do worse, and you are putting yourself in danger in some circumstances. But just because you have to be careful doesn't mean you have to be brutal. And you know, and here's what I'm really trying to get at, not that I'm doing a good job of it. It's treating everybody like they're hardened criminals when the cops obviously know, they must know, that no, we are not all hardened criminals. Hardened criminals are hardened criminals, and everybody else is everybody else. And yet they treat us like they're the only ones who are the everybody else. And the civilians, every non-cop, every non-government employee in America is a dangerous felon to be, you know, intercepted and interdicted and indefinitely detained. They treat us like we're scum. Everyone. I mean, I know from the first time I ever met a cop in person when I was a little kid, he screamed in my face like a Nazi drill sergeant and called me a damn dog and this and that. And I've hated every single cop on earth ever since then. You know, screw these guys. What natural authority does this pig have over me? None. And I see them treat every single one of my neighbors like this all day, every day. Some mom right now is being pulled over on the side of the street within a couple of miles from here and is being treated like the lowest scum of the earth by, guess who? The lowest scum of the earth. Only he's got the flashing lights and the little costume jewelry.
Well, you know, we think we do some good. I would say about 30%. If you had to put it, you know, there are some bad guys out there, and to deal with them. But, certainly I was the biggest jerk, in the world many times. And you know what? I had no idea. I did not realize that that's how I was coming across.
Yeah. Well, you know, now you're right. I mean, there are people and everything, but I can't give them the benefit of the doubt. They don't treat people like they're innocent until proven guilty, so I assume they're all guilty until proven innocent. After all, when was the last time you ever heard of a cop arresting his partner for felony assault or murder, manslaughter, whatever? Whoa, that was an unjustified shoot. You're under arrest right now, buddy. That has never happened ever, because they're all criminals. They're all just co-conspirators aiding and abetting and covering up for each other. They commit crimes all day and they never arrest each other. That's the proof that the whole barrel is bad. There may be one good apple in there, but you quit for some reason, right? What happened to that?
Well, I'll tell you. Yeah, I did 4 years on patrol. I went to detective division for 2 years, and I worked with sexual assaults and juvenile crimes. And so, hey, right? I mean, cops can't screw that up. I mean, but one of the last things where I said, hey, I've got to get out, is actually I was investigating a sexual assault, and I did not believe that the suspect actually committed the crime. And I was talking to my supervisor about it, and I was saying, now I didn't know that for sure, but I talked to my supervisor and said, hey, you know, if I was on the jury, I would not convict this guy. So why am I charging him criminally? And it was like, you know, the needle scratching across the record. Oh, wait a minute. You know, no, you can't make that decision. You've got to charge this guy. And right there, is when I, you know, just felt this, understood, moral injury. Mm-hmm. And this, hey, wait a minute, I'm fixing to basically kidnap a guy, destroy his life, even if he's found not guilty. You know, he's going to be thousands of dollars in debt and have this, you know, sexual assault arrest on his record.
Wow.
And right then I said, you know, even when you're trying to do good, the government.
So you quit then?
Government
or what
can't
happened?
Get it right. Well, I got lucky, if you can say. I was directing traffic one day and got hit by a truck.
Oh, damn. Well, but so what happened to that guy? He was prosecuted, though?
Well, he was charged. Yes, charged him.
Did you contact his lawyer?
I did, as a matter of fact. You know, he had a public defense attorney. And now I talked to the prosecutor, even after I charged him, and said, hey, you know, I'm really uncomfortable with this case. And this particular prosecutor said, yeah, okay, well, you know, we'll let the process work. And I called his defense attorney and told him my reservations. And apparently he talked to the prosecutor and got the case dismissed.
Oh, yeah, wow. I was going to say,
hey,
yeah, let the process
damage,
work.
You know,
means,
the damage was done already.
Yeah, I mean, let the jury decide, even though the prosecutor doesn't necessarily believe in it. That's good that the defense lawyer was able to get. I was going to say, when you said, you know, how can that go wrong? I was going to say, yeah, falsely accusing somebody. Because, like you said, damage is done. Even being charged is certainly on a charge like that. It's guilty till proven innocent kind of thing.
That's right. And so, you know, as far as why did I get out? Well, that decision was made for me.
Yeah. Man, well, you certainly were a good one then. That's for sure. Listen, I'm sorry, we're way over time and I got to let you go, but I hope that we can talk again. I hope you'll keep writing. I like your first one here at blueenmity.blogspot.com, Rayford, and I hope, you know, we can talk police issues again in the future.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate to speak out.
Yeah, it was really good to hear your story and to hear your point of view on this stuff. All right, so yeah, we'll talk again soon. Thank you. That's Rayford Davis, everybody. Blue Enmity. A libertarian cop's view of law enforcement at blueenmity.blogspot.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I like that guy, man. So you guys missed it. Well, should I tell you? Yeah, I'm not going to do marketing thing. Hey, you're going to want to go listen to it anyway. Later on, the archive will be posted, and you'll go listen to the end of the interview that I kept recording there during the top of the hour break. And he talked about why he quit. And why he quit was he went and got a job in the sexual assault. And he wasn't very specific on the case, but I believe he was on the, you know, team or whatever investigating sexual assault against children. And this one guy was being charged and he didn't believe in the case. And he tried to tell the other cop, hey, you know, the boss of the cops, like, hey, I don't think we should be charging this guy because I don't know for a fact that he didn't, but I just, man, I don't think that there's enough here kind of thing. And they said, hey, now that's not the way we do business here, and you're, no, 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 no. And, like, he was the one who was out of line for doing the right thing, for saying the right thing. And then, I love this guy said, yeah, well, so then what happened? Did you talk to his lawyer? He goes, hell yeah, I talked to his lawyer. And talked to the prosecutor. And then when he talked to the prosecutor said, well, let's let the process play out. In other words, she's not going to drop the charges. This is what you don't understand. When you're sitting on a jury, you just assume that the prosecutor believes the guy's guilty and is really, you know, trying to put a bad guy away. But that's not really right. The prosecutor only believes that I bet I can get a jury to say, okay, I don't really know, but let's let a jury decide. They're putting it on you. It's on you. But you assume that they really know this case really well, and they really know that this guy did it, and that's why they're they get the presumption, the benefit of the doubt. But anyway, he talked to the lawyer, the public defense attorney, public defender, and they got the case dismissed, but of course the guy's life was ruined anyway, because they charged him. And then he said he was doing traffic patrol and he got hit by a truck, and so that was his out. Saved him, and he didn't have to be a cop anymore after that. That was in response to my rant about you never see these cops arresting each other. They're all bad guys. The whole barrel is rotten. If there's one good apple, well, you quit, right? And then that was his story. Why did he quit? Because they made him do something wrong to somebody, or tried to. Anyway, so I'm sorry about the break just interrupting in the middle of the damn interview like that. Sometimes I hear the music and I think, no, forget that, man. I wasn't watching the clock and now we're in the middle of something. And so I just turn the music down and keep recording. And it sounds terrible to you guys listening live. And I'm sorry about that. But the interview archive sounds good because it keeps going. And so, yeah. Anyway, so Netanyahu is talking right now at the UN. But I'm not going to turn up the audio, should I? Eric Garris, he was taking notes in the IM for me, and then he quit. He said, I can't take it. I'm switching off. I don't have the stomach for this anymore. Hamas is ISIS, and Boko Haram, and al-Nusra, and the Mahdi army, for good measure. Some are Sunnis, some are Shiites. They're all Muslims, and we got to defeat them. Like the fanatics we defeated in 1945. That's right, the Muslims. All Muslims with power anywhere are all the Nazis, according to Benjamin Netanyahu. Iran is the biggest threat. Iran, they're the terrorists with the biggest reach. He made a slip saying refugees instead of centrifuges. Would you let ISIS develop uranium? Then you shouldn't let the Islamic State of Iran do it. Ha! Well, the Islamic State could not possibly enrich uranium. The fact that Iran can enrich uranium just goes to show that they are a stable enough society and government. That they are not the kind of radicals that Nusra represents whatsoever. But anyway, so that was where Garris gave up. Listen, his point is to try to completely and totally delegitimize Hamas as a political organization. And, they're a bunch of murderers, but they're nothing compared to him. And they haven't done a suicide attack in, 20 years or something? And even... every report, every credible report, and based on admissions by Israeli officials, say that the pretext for the last war against the Gaza Strip was fake. The three boys were kidnapped and killed by two guys who were not acting on the orders of the Hamas government in the Gaza Strip whatsoever. And Netanyahu knew it, and he rounded up hundreds, everybody who was a member of Hamas on the West Bank, basically. Round them all up, killed, I forget how many people, I don't want to say. I think it was more than 10, 6 or 10 or something like that. And then they started bombing the Gaza Strip. They did airstrikes on the Gaza Strip it's July the 6th, and then it's the 7th was when the first Hamas rockets were fired back over in response. And then that became the pretend excuse. You all saw him. History began 6 minutes ago, and those guys just fired some rockets at us. And then they proceeded to kill 2,000-something people, including 500-something children. Benjamin Adam Lanza Netanyahu, the child killer. But it's Hamas who have no legitimacy because of what horrible creatures they are. And yet, remember now, and I'm not on the side of Hamas in any sense, but I am on the side of the civilians of the Gaza Strip because they're the defenseless, innocent victims in all this. The only reason Hamas is the government there is because Benjamin Netanyahu's predecessor, Ehud Olmert, and Condoleezza Rice from the Bush government, they held an election in 2006 based on the premise that, well, listen, the Israeli government can't be expected to, first it was negotiated with the terrorist group, but then the PLO, PLA, same difference, Arafat's guys, Fatah, they forswore terrorism, and a lot of time went by, and they were just a political party and all of that, and so they said, well, but yeah, but you're not elected. And George Bush, you like democracies, right? Well, they're not elected, so how could they presume to negotiate on behalf of the people of Palestine? We must hold an election. Then they held an election, and I don't know if they deliberately rigged it or not, but they certainly, in effect, rigged it and punished Fatah and withheld all the tax revenue that Israel collects, all their border transfer revenue that they use to pay off all their constituencies and provide all their so-called services, such as they are. And so they basically brought Fatah to their knees right before the election. And then Hamas won the election that Ehud Olmert and Condoleezza Rice held. And then Elliot Abrams and Condoleezza Rice and Ehud Olmert and Hosni Mubarak, the American sock puppet dictator of Egypt, all worked together. Elliot Abrams, the neocon, and Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State at the time. They all worked to funnel a bunch of guns to Fatah in the Gaza Strip to try to kill and overthrow Hamas. They were in a coalition government. Even though Hamas had won, they said, well, let's form a coalition government. But that wasn't good enough. So they armed up Fatah, and what happened was the Hamas just kicked their ass and got the guns and kicked them out. Shot a bunch of them and kicked the rest out and took over the Gaza Strip. But so what does that make them? That makes them the strongest gang inside the Gaza prison, that's all. They're not even the prison guards. The IDF are the prison guards. Hamas are, there's no real democracy that can possibly take place inside a maximum security prison like the Gaza Strip is under Israeli siege. But every man, woman, and especially child in Gaza is somehow guilty of, even though probably half the population of Gaza wasn't even born in 2006. They're all now collectively guilty for the decisions of everyone who was an adult then. Maybe a quarter of them weren't born then. Half of them certainly were too young to vote then. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, you guys. Goddamn commercial breaks interrupting me all the time, man, you know. But listen, Hamas sucks, and yeah, they did use suicide attacks back in the last Intifada. Maybe the one before that, too, I don't know. But it's also true that the Israelis helped create Hamas in the first place in order to provide a right-wing religious alternative to the PLO. You know, divide and conquer. From the more secular leftist PLO types. Not that they were, I don't know. There's some kind of commie, but it was a different era back then. Anyway, point being, let's break them apart. That's why Netanyahu, took advantage of the kidnapping and murder of those three boys. He pretended for 3 weeks that he thought the boys were still alive and that they were looking for him and that they were going to negotiate over him and getting the people of Israel's hopes up for 3 weeks, even though they were lying the whole damn time, just to create a pretext for war to split them apart because the PLA and Hamas had just signed an agreement. And, let me think of who's best on this, because I read some pretty good stuff about this, man. You know what? I think I might drop the ball in the footnote here for you guys. You could look into it anyway. You got search terms and internet browsers. But what had happened basically was that the Hamas government, by signing on to the coalition government with the Fatah organization in the West Bank, were basically signing on to all of Fatah's positions. Fatah's positions being as far as they've gone, which up until then had been quite a bit further than Hamas in recognizing Israel in all these other particulars. You know, I don't know all the particulars. Hamas has been willing to recognize Israel for a long time, of course. But they were basically dropping their agenda and signing on to the more secular, moderate, acceptable, previously absolutely unacceptable, but now acceptable compared to Hamas, Fatah PLA government, led by Abu Mazen, Abu Abbas. So that was why they took advantage of the kidnapping of the and murder of the three teenagers, was in order to go to war to try to break the government apart, which didn't really work. But anyway, yeah, you can read Andrew Higgins in the Wall Street Journal, and you can read Richard Sale at UPI. And you know what? I know one more good one. Somewhere in my brain, I got a third good footnote about this. What was it? Oh, man, I swear I knew a third footnote. Well, there's Andrew Higgins in the Wall Street Journal, Richard Sale in UPI about how Israel helped to create Hamas. Oh, yes, they did. No, there's a third footnote in there somewhere. But anyway, so no, Hamas, they suck 1,000 ways. They're a would-be government, okay? They're politicians. I hate their sorry guts. There's no question about, you know, me or anyone who agrees with me necessarily being apologists for them or for their position necessarily or anything else. But to say that they're ISIS is just a damn lie. Look at why Al-Qaeda hates Hamas. It's the same reason Al-Qaeda hates the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria and in Egypt. Because they run for elections, well, especially in Egypt. They run for elections. They participate in the Western game of nation states and democratic governments. They're playing the Israelis and the Americans game, even having elections at all, even thinking that anything short of an Islamo-fascist caliphate ruled by Zawahiri or Baghdadi or Golani or you pick your caliph can possibly ever be the true righteous blah, blah, blah. So where these ISIS guys just round up Shiite men by the hundreds and execute them all. I've seen the videos. Have you seen the videos of ISIS massacring civilians? Oh, yeah. Hamas doesn't do that. Hamas doesn't round up hundreds of people for being Shiites and murder them, nor would they either. Obviously, they don't have access to that many Shiites to murder. But still, it's not like that's their agenda at all. No one believes that. And what Netanyahu's really saying is, my position is completely illegitimate, and so I have to lie, because otherwise I've got no case to make. Hamas is willing to recognize Israel. The reason that they say, you got to call us a Jewish state, even though 20% of the population are Arab, Christians, and Muslims, is just to move the goalposts, to just pretend that, oh, look, another reason that there's just no partner for peace on the other side. Even though everyone knows it, hell. And President of the United States, not that he's willing to do a damn thing about it, but in his own UN speech just the other day, said, come on, everybody knows the only sustainable alternative, the only thing that you could possibly do here is give up the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem for a Palestinian state. There's got to be a Palestinian state. You can't just occupy them forever. Soon there'll be the clear majority, and you'll be a minority country. Then you'll have forsaken democracy entirely in order to maintain your Jewish majority, supermajority in your government, and da-da-da. Everybody knows that, the president said, and of course he's right. Even though he's the lead American making sure that we all continue footing the bill for such a project. They didn't really care about Gaza, but Judea and Samaria, as the Likudniks call the West Bank, why, that's part of Greater Israel, and they mean to steal it. oh, the Palestinians just want them dead. The Palestinians just want to end the occupation of Palestine. You know, I don't know, man, about how universal this is, really, but I'm willing to bet that most people who are just by default anti-Palestinian, pro-Israel, and assume that and talk about the Palestinians as terrorists who just won't leave the Israelis alone, actually don't understand the geography and the fact of the occupation. Show them a map and explain how this part right here, the West Bank, this is where everybody lives there as a Palestinian other than these illegal colonial settlers. But otherwise, this is Palestinian land, and there are millions of Palestinians still live there, only they're under foreign martial law, and they have been for 47 years. See, the police and military are a foreign government's police and military occupying their land. Same for East Jerusalem. And then look at the Gaza Strip, see. You imagine Israel as this tiny, helpless strip of land surrounded by all these Arab enemy states. That's actually just not true. All of the Arab states surrounding Israel are either their loyal sock puppets like Egypt and Jordan, or completely helpless like the Syrians and Hezbollah in Lebanon right now. It's the Gaza Strip that is a tiny microcosm of tiny Israel by the sea there, and it's under complete and total siege and occupation by a foreign government that controls all their trade, travel, communication, association, and everything else. They're under complete and total lockdown. As Israeli critics themselves say, it's a maximum security prison. It's like Kurt Russell, Escape from New York, Prison by the Sea. That's what it is. It's a giant, you know, abandoned but imprisoned concentration camp penned in by the Israelis and their Egyptian sock puppets there in the now Sisi government instead of Mubarak. The next mustache in line, as Greg Palast would call him. That's the truth of it. The Israelis are the aggressors, the occupiers, and the Palestinians are their victims. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott, so yeah, it's my show. Hey, listen, so I didn't get to see the Netanyahu thing because for some reason they didn't closed caption it on CNN. In fact, they're not closed captioning anything on CNN right now. Well, I'm on CNN International. Maybe that's from. I don't know. Anyway, so Netanyahu talked about Iran, and all I know is that Eric Garris wrote in the notes that he said, oh, would you let ISIS develop uranium? Well, then you can't let Iran either. And I kind of went off on the different tangent. Let me get back to that for a second. Iran has the unalienable right, quote unquote, capital U, capital R, unalienable right to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. It's in the treaty. They signed it, and guess who else signed it? Every permanent member of the UN Security Council, including the United States of America, which means not only does Iran have the right to enrich uranium, but the United States, the United Kingdom, France, China, and Russia are all bound to respect that right, and in fact even help them to develop nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. At the same time, according to that treaty, since they are a non-nuclear weapons state, unlike the UN Security Council powers, they are bound, they have agreed under the treaty that they have willfully signed, they have agreed to a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency that the International Atomic Energy Agency may verify the non-diversion of their nuclear material. And they have to declare where they're going to be introducing any nuclear material into any actual operations 6 months before, which they've always done, despite whatever hype you've heard in any particular case. The international nuclear cops basically track all of their uranium from womb to tomb, from the mine to the centrifuge, all the way through the refining to the yellow cake uranium, the conversion to uranium hexafluoride gas, and the transport to the Natanz and Com facilities where the stuff is enriched. And none of it's ever been reported missing, ever. And the way the IAE puts it is almost like they're claiming to prove a negative. We have continued to verify the non-diversion. We have proven what has not happened. We've continued to verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose. That's the way they say it, over and over and over and over again. So, the thing is, point being, they're not making nuclear weapons. They're not in violation of the treaty. They're not in violation of their safeguards agreement. They have the unalienable right to peaceful nuclear technology. And in fact, if they withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which they can do, just like North Korea did when Bush hit them in the head over and over again in 2002 and 3 and forced them out deliberately because he's a stupid idiot, and pushed them to nuclear weapons where before they had none, they could do that if they wanted. They took the opposite tactic for dealing with Bush and Obama since. From North Korea, where North Korea said, oh yeah, well, we're going to make nukes. And how do you like that? And what are you going to do about it? The Iranians said, hey, look, our hands are up. Your cops are standing around with, tricorder do-wackies at our facilities. So, you know, it's all cool. Don't shoot. Hands up. Don't shoot. The Iranians cried. And that's what they've done. They just opened up all their books and they've said, go and inspect. And all the controversies, every last one of their little points, oh yeah, well what about this? Oh yeah, well what about that? All of it's debunked. Every conspiracy theory about Iran's nuclear program, debunked by the heroic Gareth Porter in the book Manufactured Crisis. And with a lot of help from his friends in his footnotes, I don't mean his friends, a lot of help from the facts and from scientists and from experts and from... yeah, it's the real truth as opposed to all the crap that you heard. And yet Benjamin Netanyahu's obsession. Oh, Iran, Iran, Iran. And so, you know, I really don't know all the time. I go back and forth. I can't be a fly on the wall in these places. I wish I could. I do love to speculate, and I would like to leap to conclusions, but I try very hard not to. But, you know, I don't really know if this is all America's Middle East policy is really an actual smart thing run by Israel firsters who know exactly what they're doing when they, for example, abolish Saddam's army or back the remnants of it in Syria 10 years later, or the other kind of mad acts that they participate in, just so that they can, of course, energize the very worst people, the ISISs and the Muqtada al-Sadrs of the different factions, the worst murderers of the different factions, in order that they can justify a more militarist and right-wing foreign policy at home there in Israel, and to just weaken all their enemies, like in the Oded Yanan plan. I always forget his first name. I believe it's O-D-E-D. Oded Yanan, who wrote this ridiculous thing. If you read it, it's absolutely ridiculous, okay? It comes from like 1981, and he sounds just like Norman Podhoretz or something. Oh, woe is me! The Soviet Union is conquering the world! Liberalism, you know, little L. Liberalism will forever die! Democracy is over! Freedom is over! Markets are over! Mankind faces a bleak, totalitarian, Frankenstein, living death slavery, and we're all gonna die, and the only choice that Israel has in this situation is to break the entire Middle East into warring tribal factions of weak leaders, armed with nothing better than AKs in effect. He didn't say it that way, but just break them into as many warring tribal pieces with no real borders at all as you can, and just whatever. This is the most bleak outlook for the turn of the 21st century that he could possibly have. And then so Israel has no choice but to resort to this madness. And you certainly see echoes of that in a clean break, but I really, and in fact, a clean break is one, but it's David Wormser, Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor, also wrote, and this one maybe is more important, another study for the same institute for blah, 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 I forgot what it's called, in Israel. You can find them both at my website, scotthorton.org/fair use. And you'll see a clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm. And the other one is called Coping with Crumbling States. And in there, he focuses much more on Syria. And this is where you'll find that magic phrase. It's sometimes quoted out of context as applying to Iraq, but it's actually about Syria. And he says, this is where what we want to do is expedite the chaotic collapse in order that we may better control the future. Blah, blah, blah. And now this is the guy that Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff, said was the agent of influence for Israel. He's the guy that Dick Cheney put in the State Department in the first 4 years of the Bush Jr. term in order to keep control of Colin Powell, really to sabotage Colin Powell. And but Colin Powell's aide, Wilkerson, says Wormser and Feith, too, were both outright agents of Israel. You know, Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz and all them, yeah, they're a bunch of Israel firsters and everything, but they weren't outright acting as agents for a foreign power in the way that Wormser and Feith were. And but here's the giant caveat, though. I don't think, and I guess I need to go back and reread Coping with Crumbling States, but I don't believe that he really says, yeah, we want a bunch of tiny little warring tribal factions forever and chaos in there. I don't believe he calls for chaos. I believe it's written from the point of view of the American military, especially, but even the Israeli one, that basically they're all powerful and they can do whatever they want, and that the idea that uncontrollable chaos could result from their actions, that's just not in their way of thinking. Chaos, maybe, for a time. But as he said, expedite the chaotic collapse so that then you put it back together again the way you want. This is why Bush said, bring them on. Right? He didn't imagine that there was anyone who would even look funny at the U.S. Army. Why? How could they even think that they could look at us sideways? But of course, others have other agendas in wars sometimes. So, anyway, I don't know. It's interesting stuff to think about, and again, you can find it all at scotthorton.org/fair use there. David Wormser, A Clean Break and Coping with Crumbling States. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And Raymond Govern's coming up here in just a little while. So that should be good. Good old Ray. All right, so, yeah, I think I talked enough about Palestine and Iran for now. Stupid old Benjamin Netanyahu's talk there at the UN. As far as I know about it. I'm going to try to get somebody on about Hong Kong tomorrow. I never really had to interview anybody about Hong Kong before, so I didn't really know who to contact, but Doug Bandon knows everything about everything, so I'm going to try to make it be him. But anyway, I don't know. We'll see what we can do. Did you guys watch Dear Leader on 60 Minutes last night? You know, I really don't like Barack Obama. I admit that George Bush brought out the rage in me. God, I just hate him so much to this day. The ruiner of all things good. Held the entire world in his hands and just blew it. Pathetic little spiteful little. I just hate that guy. George W. Bush. But Barack Obama, God, what a lousy president this guy is. Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. I don't mean to take your Lord's name in vain. I don't usually think along those lines and I forget. But I'm trying to get better about it. So no offense. For crying out loud, for Pete's sake, dadgummit. Did you see this loser, this pathetic loser president on 60 Minutes last night. It's really fun to, as much as I hate his voice like Sarah Palin, I just can't listen to him at all. I have to force myself to listen to him. But it's fun to watch his facial expressions and his body language where he's going, and he's trying to like hurry the guy up and make him finish his asking the question already and stuff. And the way he looks at him and the way his eyes dart around on some things, it's just fun to watch him. He's such a... such a loser, Barack Obama. I mean, he's the most powerful guy in the world, Scott. I know, but he's the biggest loser ever to be the president. I think that much is certain. But anyway, so I mentioned before about his Freudian slip there about the Marines. And the soldiers. About how when he... I don't know. Maybe sending the Marines is a cliche too. It just seemed to me like if he wanted to just stick with the cliche, he would have just said, "I'm not sending the army," and that when he said the Marines, it was more an allusion to real discussions that have been taking place lately. Because as I've been telling you, since before the fall of Mosul, if you accept the premise that these guys have to be destroyed by somebody, and that somebody. Well, if they've got to be destroyed, it's got to be the U.S. You know, if it's Americans deciding it's got to be destroyed, then what are they going to do? Just wait around to see what happens? And that's what I say. I say ISIS or the Islamic State is completely landlocked, completely surrounded by enemy states and enemy populations, and is attempting a totalitarian takeover of every facet of every life in Sunnistan that they've seized. And if history's any guide, the locals are going to get sick and tired of them and start shooting them. Everybody gives Petraeus the credit, but he showed up late and bribed them to do what they were doing anyway, which was turning on what was left of Zarqawi's guys at the end of 06 and 07, and beginning of 07. Anyway, but what are they going to do? They're going to have to send in the Marines. I don't think the Peshmerga or the Iraqi army, how many more billions of dollars and how many years are they going to have to spend rebuilding the Iraqi army to where it can invade and conquer Sunnistan? And that's the thing about Obama's talk last night more than anything else. The biggest dishonesty of his whole interview was that there's this country named Iraq and that we've been invited by this government to help them. No, it's not a war. We are not at war. We are just supporting the people around there in taking care of the Iraqis, and, you know, he didn't mean everybody around, the Iraqis, and taking back their country. But it's not. I mean, he's just a damn liar, and he knows good and well that the Iraqi army is the Badr Brigade, is made out of the Badr Brigade, that all of the militias, even Sadr's formerly more nationalist militia, is now all of them completely reliant upon and in line with the agenda of the Iranians next door. And that, no, Sunnistan, Western and Northwestern Iraq is not their country. It does not belong to them. If the tribal alliance, the Sunni tribal alliance with ISIS means anything, it's that they have declared independence from Iraq. So, yeah, you're talking about not even... It's a pretense that the Iraqi government has invited us to come and help them. It's completely a pretense. What has happened is America has invaded the Islamic State. We've been invited to keep some troops in Shiistan and in Kurdistan for use in our invasion of the Islamic State, which does exist. And that's what's really going on here. So they can't even be honest with you at all. They can't admit that Sykes-Picot is over. That, you know, maybe it won't be one state between eastern Syria and western Iraq by the time the Islamic State finally is, Baghdadi and his group are finally, routed and driven out of power. It may not be one state, but it's not going to be Iraq and it's not going to be Syria, at least under old borders anymore. They still may call Shiistan Iraq, and they still may call Shiistan Syria over there in Assad land. But there's something new taking shape in between, that's for sure. And because of the Israeli politics of the matter, to be perfectly frank about it, I guess whatever, the Saudis and the Qataris have their interests too and all that. But they just cannot for the life of them. Not that I'm recommending this, but it at least makes sense from the Empire's point of view. But they still can't ally with Assad and help his state army crush al-Nusra and the Islamic State. Which, if there is an American national interest in kicking these al-Qaeda guys out of power and getting as many of them killed as possible so that they pose as little a threat to the American people as possible, at least on the face of it. I'm not saying it wouldn't backfire and be horrible. I'm a complete 100,000% non-interventionist here. But I'm just saying they can't even do that, even in the context of intervening here. They still are bent. They're claiming on creating a third force to fight Assad or what? Ignore Assad? They're going to try to convince Assad to ignore them too? And then, but what? They're going to fight al-Nusra and ISIS? And the al-Nusra guys more and more are joining forces with ISIS. They're both being bombed by the Americans together. So the al-Nusra guys, that split is healing. And I don't know about Baghdadi and Golani, the leaders of the two, whether they're going to be able to get it together. I read a thing that said it would have to be Zawahiri from Pakistan telling Golani, go ahead and go with Baghdadi, basically. For that to really work out. But all his fighters are leaving and switching sides anyway, so it's almost a moot point at this point. Al-Qaeda is being routed PR-wise by the Islamic State, even though Zawahiri may be right that they're getting ahead of themselves and that they can't really even attempt this until the Americans are all the way gone. But anyway, point being, they're still claiming this moderate army of the Free Syrian Army is going to fight Assad and all the jihadists, the extremist jihadists, as opposed to the Free Syrian Army. And, you know, like Mitchell Prothero said on the show, a McClatchy newspaper reporter, that, look, the moderates, the Free Syrian Army, the ones who aren't, you know, cut your head off Islamists, which actually the Free Syrian Army does cut people's heads off sometimes, but it's not exclusively made up of bin Ladenites. But still, the ones who aren't bin Ladenites are just criminals. They're just gangsters and murderers and kidnappers and thieves, outlaws in a war zone. And, oh yeah, sometimes they fight Assad too. It may be sad as a fact, but okay, so it's a sad fact that the entire Syrian uprising was hijacked by the CIA, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, and the remnants of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And it turned into a civil war, a jihadi civil war, beginning way back in 2011. It was already on since way back then. All this time, a woulda, coulda, shoulda tried to back the moderates. Hillary tried that. Hillary had 2 years of trying to put together coalition governments of Syrian national councils and Syria national alliances and whatever, and all these different meetings. But the war has belonged to al-Qaeda in Iraq, a.k.a. the al-Nusra Front, and then later ISIS split off from them all along since the first year of the war. That's the truth of this. They've been really guilty of treason all along back in this jihad, back in the veterans of the Iraq War. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. Jeez. I'm glad I forgot to call Ray McGovern until right now. Boy, oh boy. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And on the line, I got Ray McGovern. Now, Ray McGovern, he was a CIA analyst for 27 years, and now he's a peacenik. And back before the Iraq War, maybe right after 9/11, somewhere around there, he helped to create the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And so what that means is they write memos. Oftentimes, Ray writes them. But signed by many former intelligence professionals from the military, the intelligence agencies, the FBI, et cetera. And then they recommend usually that government either stop doing something or please don't start doing the thing that you're planning on starting to do. That's basically what it's about. Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You can find most of his essays at consortiumnews.com, and his own website is raymcgovern.com, and we rerun virtually everything he writes at antiwar.com as well. That's original.antiwar.com/McGovern. And now, finally, welcome back to the show, Ray. How are you?
Thanks, Scott. Doing well.
All right. Good times. Good to have you back on. So, tell me about this, lawsuit against Hillary Clinton's, was it against her or just against, the U.S. State Department. There's an article by Peter Van Buren at dissenter.firedoglake.com all about how you had a victory in the courts.
Yeah, I didn't realize what a victory it was, but the lawyers that decided to take my case, the Partnership for a Civil Justice Fund, tell me that this is quite an achievement. What they did was pursue a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, and they found out when they finally got the material out of the State Department that I had been put on a BOLO list. BOLO meaning be on the lookout for Ray McGovern. If you see him, stop him, detain him, and question him, because he has dissident views on what the U.S. government is doing, and he's got a following because people think he knows something since he works for the CIA for 27 years. That was pretty much it. And when the lawyers saw that, they said, my goodness, you know, here's the State Department arresting or having arrested McGovern for simply standing up during a Hillary Clinton speech back in February of what? 3 years ago now, February of whatever that is, February 2001 or 2011, and not saying anything, but simply standing there silently, just to give her the notion that not everyone in that same auditorium thought that she was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I was beat up, put in prison, put in a jail for a while. Several hours, and then these wonderful lawyers volunteered to help me out, and so they filed this FOIA. Now, the litigation that followed the revelation by the State Department that it had put me on the BOLO list, well, that was a painful process, but the victory lies in the fact that they admitted it, that the BOLO was rescinded, that the State Department notified any other federal agency that might have been in receipt of this, that it was rescinded. And that's victory number one in this case. Number two comes when the people who beat me up are held accountable. And we hope that that will be within the next year or so. Justice grinds very slow in Washington, D.C.
Mm. Well, I hope you have a framed copy of this wanted poster hanging on the wall in your office. This is great.
I don't, but I really should. You know, I was looking at the post office to see if they were up in the wall, but I was spared that.
Oh, no, that's too bad. No, that would have been even better. No, anyway, so yeah, no, I'm sure I interviewed you at the time. I think I remember interviewing you at the time over this. It's a good thing that you did. And it's really too bad the way that they put their hands on you, I guess. Not worse than we would expect, but still pretty bad. And then, of course, trying to pretend you're a criminal, trying to pretend that you're some kind of threat to her. Come on. Who do these guys think they're kidding?
You know, Scott, there's some good that comes out of all this stuff. No bones were broken, just a whole bunch of bruises, contusions and stuff. But what happened was this. When my Veterans for Peace colleagues, I was wearing their shirt, so it was very prominent that I was a member of Veterans for Peace. When they learned about this, they publicized the fact that I was 71 years old at the time. And long story short, American people don't like old folks to get beat up that way. Okay? They don't care. You know, these young people, they have it coming to them. But people with the color hair I have, and then they lay it out a little thick, the Veterans for Peace, say, well, you know, he's a cancer survivor too, which I was at the time, and I'm still, thank God. So what happened was Hillary Clinton got thousands of telephone calls, emails. It was quite a performance on the part of the American people. Now, why do I mention that? Because maybe some of your listeners have the same color, gray or white, that I do. Please realize, if you do, you have a big advantage. You just let yourself be beat up a little bit, and American people will care about that, you know? So put yourself out there, get your body into it, and see what happens, because only we, I think, in this generation who realize the indignities that have been perpetrated on the Constitution and other things, only we can kind of get into the mix here and right. put ourselves on the line.
Well, and you know, it's one of those things where it teaches so much just in context. They're like, hey, what are those nuns doing breaking into that Air Force base? Okay, wait, so I know I worship the Air Force as my first Lord and Savior in the world and everything, but nuns are nuns, and they pretty much are assumed to always be of benevolent motives. So, something nuclear they're protesting, huh? And the judges, what? Putting them in jail for how long? And this is how people who are, you know, pretty apolitical and uninitiated get interested in these kinds of things and get their perspective changed a little bit. You know, when they come up against dissidents, like, well, geez, why is this old guy getting himself, no offense, getting himself arrested out in front of the White House? Why is he wearing an orange jumpsuit and crying war crimes here? This former CIA officer, why would he dare accuse his government of going so far? And it's because they have gone so far.
Well, you know, Scott's sister Megan, to whom you referred, she was the one that broke through the wire at the most maximum security part of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where the actual plutonium is stored. And she's a good friend of mine. And it's example like that that gives me the courage to do what little I can do when people like Hillary Clinton show up and everybody else thinks she's the cat's pajamas, as we used to say in the Bronx. So, you know, what I recommend is get a model. Get somebody who is just doing the good for because it's good, and think about them in prison and think about yourself outside like I am, and that will give you a little bit more incentive, a little bit more courage to do what's required today. And what I think is required is for us to put our bodies into it.
Yeah. Well, it's a real good point. And in fact, you know, I'm not very good at practicing what I preach about that at all. Going to the protests, organizing and doing that kind of activism. But I'm among the first to complain that where's the anti-war left in an era of Obama wars? Where are the giant demonstrations to prove that there are people out here who really do care? Because, again, even if it doesn't impress power, it's good for the kids in the neighborhood to see that, hey, there are some people out there who are saying that their government is as wrong as it could possibly be and they have to stop now. If people don't see that example, it's not made. Oh, man, and now we got to go to break, right? Because I talked all the way up till the music like I always do.
No problem.
But when we get back, we're going to talk about wars. We got Ray McGovern on the phone. He's a veteran intelligence professional for sanity, which shouldn't be asking too much. I don't know. A little bit of sanity here, there. Maybe here, but not there. We'll compromise. Just a second. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Ray McGovern, former CIA officer, now peace nick. He's been traveling all over the world. Last time we talked to him, he was, I forget, were you still in Russia or you were in Germany on your way home? Anyway, and he's been traveling all over America giving speeches He travels all around giving speeches. Go to raymcgovern.com to find out details. It's, what is it? Tell the Word is the name of the organization. Ray, is that right?
That's right. That's right, Scott. Tell the Word.
Tell the Word. And you can find out how to invite Ray to come and, speak to your group and teach him some things and why to put peace first, especially and all that. So, really great stuff, of course. And so, I almost don't know where to begin. With the mess in the countries formerly known as Iraq and Syria, and now the new Islamic State, Ray, and the war against them. But I guess I'll ask you about really even the premise that I don't know if you saw Obama's interview last night on 60 Minutes where he talked about how, you know, we got to build up the Iraqi army so that they can go and retake their soil, their land. I think, yeah, their soil. I wrote it in quotes in my notes, so I think it was a quote. When, in fact, the west and northwest of Iraq has declared independence. That's what their alliance, the tribal alliance with ISIS, means, really. And so isn't it true that all the president's saying is we're going to help the Baata Brigade dressed up in American uniforms, Shiite sectarian militias, we're going to have them conquer and defeat the predominantly Sunni parts of the country that have declared independence. So, and then the second part of that question is that even possible when even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says that only half the army's any good? And by that, he must mean a third or a quarter.
Well, Scott, this would be funny, if it weren't so serious. Let me try to be a little funny and say, well, that worked in 2007. That was the big surge. Remember? Bush and Cheney were going to lose a war on their watch, and so they sent 30,000 more U.S. troops so that the Baata Brigades and all the Shia could change Baghdad by changing it into a predominantly Shia city after it had been a predominantly Sunni city. That's called, what's it called? That's called population extermination, or there's another call.
Sectarian cleansing would be the euphemism, but yeah, forced relocation, Trail of Tears, Forced March, Andrew Jackson, pseudo half a genocide, something.
Yeah, and of course, you know, after you do that, you sort of get the Sunnis a little ticked off at you, and of course, Maliki was a disaster. So it's not funny. It is 7 years later. And what's happening now is a situation that Obama is behaving as though he doesn't know anything about Iraq and Afghanistan, much less Vietnam. And I don't know about his advisors, you know, those really tough women, especially, you know, what do they know about war? Now, I thought General Dempsey could be depended upon to act in a sort of constitutional way. He prevailed this time last year, if you'll recall, when Obama and Kerry were all set to launch the cruise missiles at Syria. Finally, Dempsey said, look, you know, we don't have to do this today. Tomorrow, we do it next week. And besides, you know, you probably should take a look at the Constitution there, because Article 1 reserves the right to make war to Congress, the representatives of the people. Now, that, together with some help from Vladimir Putin, that very, very, very bad person who sometimes has no shirt on and sometimes rides horse with no shirt on and invaded Ukraine and all that kind of stuff. Putin bailed our president out this time last year. And guess what? Those Syrian chemical weapons have all been destroyed. You won't find out in the New York Times, but that's the fact. So what are we doing now? Well, the interesting thing is that we have a new group that was invented in the Pentagon. And I thought it was a rug, you know, Karistan rugs I know about, but this is Khorasan. And nobody ever knew about it, not even in the intelligence community, until the Pentagon sort of dreamed it up. Why did they want to dream it up? Because to make some sort of halfway credible claim that there's an imminent threat to the United States, you have to be able to cite some sort of blog spot or some sort of statement by this terrible group that says they're going to kill Americans. Now, unfortunately, al-Nusra and the other really radical groups there in Syria and Iraq They're after Assad. They're after other people. They're not after the United States. And so nobody could find, and nobody could even forge a statement that they made that they're trying to kill Americans. But ha ha, get this Khorasan group invented by the Pentagon. And guess what? They have made some statements threatening American lives. And so what? What do? We justified this new war by citing them. Now, what's really bizarre about this? Well, what's bizarre about this is that The Intercept, that wonderful new website, has identified this fellow named Ken Delanian, who works for the AP now, but he used to work for LA Times. Mm-hmm. He surfaced this story and got everybody preaching from the same legend. And then when James Comey and others said, well, we're not really sure that it was imminent. And what do you mean by imminent? And anyway, we don't really. Then Delanian is the same guy who backs off. See? So what's the lesson there? Very simple, Scott. Whoever lies first wins.
Yeah, that's it. And just it's amazing, and it shouldn't be amazing, but it is amazing that they lied just as well about the Yazidis on the mountain, too. And then they admitted that they were lying, or they didn't call it a lie, but they said, oh, yeah, 400,000 stranded by a bunch of, and surrounded by a bunch of beheaders or whatever. Nothing like that. Everybody already ran away. There never were 400,000. There were a couple of tens of thousands, and there's quite a few thousands left on the mountain, 5,000 or 6,000, and they don't want to leave, and they're not afraid, and there's no ISIS trying to kill them. And it wasn't even ISIS that killed any of them. It was their neighbors who turned on them, who had no connection to ISIS whatsoever. It was the next village over. And that whole thing on Mount Sinjar was fake for the invasion of Iraq. And then they do the same thing again in Syria, where they just, we'll just make up a little thing.
Like they're making movies. Now, those of us who care about the Constitution and remember how the Libyan war was conducted, and it was not really considered necessary to declare it a war. It was just a kinetic action, okay? After that, and this is a fellow I don't usually praise, but Senator Jeff Sessions, a Republican from Alabama, I think, he questioned Dempsey and then Secretary of Defense Panetta in a thing that's still on YouTube. And after Panetta got explaining what he called the legal basis for what the Obama administration did in Libya and what it would feel very free to do in Syria, Sessions, and I looked at him, I think it was true. He confessed, he pronounced himself, quote, almost breathless.
Hang on one second. Give me one more segment. We'll be right back with Ray McGovern, everybody.
All right.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I got Ray McGovern. I coerced him into staying one more segment with us here. It's the Scott Horton Show, where former CIA officers come on to debunk the latest war propaganda. Khorasan. Phil Giraldi was on last week. Khorasan. Let me tell you, that's a bunch of hype. This is just the Al-Nusra Front. They've been Al-Qaeda this whole time, and they ain't coming here anyway. How are they supposed to get here? Yeah, Ray McGovern's on, and when we were interrupted by the break, Ray, you were talking about the outrageous pseudo-legality of the war in Libya and then how that applies to the current war breaking out in Iraq and Syria as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Scott, it's a matter of considerable importance to those of us who took a solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that not many legislators in the House or in the Senate seem to care about that very much, and they're just happy to escape their duty to either authorize or not authorize the next war. Now, the last time this came to a real head was back in March of 2012, after the debacle on Libya, which is a failed state now because of our intervention together with the French and the Italians that wanted that Libyan oil. So what happened was there was a Senate Armed Services Committee meeting, and Senator Sessions attended, Republican from Alabama, who is a lawyer, you know, and he said, you know, hey, do you think you can do the same thing in Syria by pretending, as you did in Libya, that this wasn't a war? And as I say, you know, let me just quote you the back and forth, just one sentence each from Sessions and then Secretary of Defense Panetta. Sessions, I'm really baffled. The only legal authority that's required to deploy the U.S. military in combat is Congress, not NATO, not coalitions of the willing, Congress and the president and the law and the Constitution, end quote. Panetta, quote, let me just for the record be clear again, Senator, so there's no misunderstanding. When it comes to national defense, the president has the authority under the Constitution to act to defend this country, and we will, sir. Oh, God. Talk about imperial hubris. So here's a lawyer, Panetta, right? Uh-huh. San Diego, or went to school out there in the West, and he's a big, big hero out there. And he's saying, look, just for the record, the president has all the authority that Dick Cheney said Bush had, and we can make war at will. Why does this matter?
Well, wait. And also, he deliberately lied, but he did so in such a way where everybody knows it. It's just a figure of speech, and damn it, you will accept his figure of speech, defend this country by doing whatever it is he wants, including launching aggressive wars against countries that have not attacked us.
Well, just like George Bush, yeah. And if you want to just Google Panetta and Sessions, and you'll come up with that 7-minute video. You'll be left, as Sessions said he was, what did he say? Almost breathless. Now, what matters here is Dempsey. Now, General Dempsey prevented a war last year. He went to the president after John Kerry had said 35 times, and I counted them, we know that Bashar al-Assad has violated your red line there by perpetrating chemical attack. We know, we know, we know. And he said that on the afternoon of August 30th of last year. Dempsey got to the president that evening and said, Mr. President, with all due respect to your Secretary of State, he doesn't know. Matter of fact, the intelligence people are telling me that the rebels have the capability of preparing a homemade kind of sarin. And the English, the British tell me, after having acquired a sample of that sarin, that it is not the kind of sarin that is in Syrian government troops' arsenals. Okay, so Mr. President, you might want to think, you blame it on me. Tell them tomorrow that I said you don't have to do this today, tomorrow, next year. You could do, there's no time sensitivity, and that's exactly what Obama said just 20 hours after Kerry made the case for war. Now, why am I saying that? Well, because this time, Dempsey seems to be going along. And that is really tragic. He was a guy with some principles back then. We wrote him a memo and said, if you're ordered to do, well, actually, he testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee saying, look, if I'm ordered to do a war, I'm going to have to think if Congress doesn't act, because I owe Congress as much responsibility as I do the president. And this year he seems to be going along. So we're about to send him a follow-up memo. We hate to do this every year, but we're going to say, General Dempsey, remember what you told Carl Levin and the Senate Armed Services Committee about the Constitution and how you're sworn to abide by that? Well, do it again, General Dempsey. Cut out this crazy stuff. This is a quagmire, and even the president has admitted 2-3 more years. End it now and stop sending poverty draft people from towns in this country of less than 50,000 and from the inner city. We call it a volunteer army. Well, it's a poverty draft. You know it, and you're responsible for leading us back to safe land, and that safe land is Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah, it's amazing the way that they're doing this when, of course, they can get a resolution through Congress, no problem right now. And they're just choosing not to in a very Dick Cheney, David Addington, let's go ahead and torture them and see if anybody tries to stop us kind of a way.
That's it, you know. And as I say, in a letter, a formal letter to Carl Levin last year at this time, Dempsey said, quote, "The decision to use force is not one that any of us takes lightly. It's an act of war." Okay? End quote. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that if it's an act of war, the Constitution requires that the Congress authorize it. We've come a long way from that, but those of us who took an oath to the Constitution, we feel strongly about this, just as we feel strongly about the fudging of the Fifth Amendment, which says...
Well, you know, on this, the thing is, really, once they conceded the principle that all they got to do is authorize it and not actually take the responsibility themselves and declare war, that once they conceded the principle, it was just a matter of time before the entire thing was gone. Because really, an authorization, the way Hillary Clinton spun it, not that it was good enough to acquit her, but she was technically right, that all she did was give the authority to Bush to decide. She thought he needed that authority like a gun in his holster so that he wouldn't have to pull it out and wouldn't have to actually commit to violence. He just needed the authority to intimidate Hussein into going along, whatever, whatever. But it was Bush's decision to go to war, not hers, even though she voted yes. But and Ron Paul was saying, and in fact, Henry Hyde, the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, told Ron Paul, oh, come on, the Constitution, that part of the Constitution is an anachronism. We don't go by that anymore.
Scott, I hate to call you too soft on anyone. You're usually not, but you're far too soft on Hillary. She knew chapter and verse about how the intelligence was not mistaken, but it was fraudulent.
Oh, yeah. No. I don't mean that. Oh, she's guilty as hell. Put her right on the gallows. I'll pull the trap door. All I'm saying is, technically speaking, all she did was authorize the president to decide rather than actually declare war in a sense, like in the name of the Senate. You know what I mean?
Well, voting for the bill allowing the president to have that kind of capability is tantamount to voting for war. She did that because she knew she had to be really tough, and then she would win the presidency the next time around. And the height of irony is, of course, that it contributed greatly to her defeat for the nomination, because Obama had said that he was against Iraq. So, yeah, all I'm saying is that I feel very close to this because Scott Ritter, who is a good friend of mine, tried to get to see Hillary Clinton, who he was a constituent of, okay? Mm. He knew chapter and verse about how all the WMD had been destroyed. She wouldn't let him in the front door.
Yeah.
And she just didn't want to hear about it. So
she was married to the last president. She knew, and Bill knew, and they all knew, as Scott said, they knew from 1995 that they hadn't manufactured a single bit of chemical anything since 91 when they got busted trying to hide a little bit, and that was the end of that. They knew from 95 on, clean bill of health. Give me a break.
Sure, and how they get away with this, of course, Scott, is the rest of the story, and in every interview or every speech I make, I always point out that in 51 years here in Washington, you see a lot of change, but there's no change more consequential than the fact that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media. The fourth estate is dead. The good news is that there's a fifth estate. That's what we're doing, you and I, right now. And there's great hope in that, because as I go around the colleges, I see nobody reads the Washington Post, the New York Times. They're all online. All we need to do is make sure that they get onto the best websites. And one of those, of course, is antiwar.com.
Yeah, well, thanks for saying so. And, I'm sorry now, really sorry that I got in a dumb fight, completely off topic. It was really a one-sided fight with Robert Perry, where he wrote something I didn't like, and I wrote some rude thing to him, so now I can't interview him anymore. I guess I need to just say sorry, but
He writes about one article a day, so he doesn't really give interviews to very many people.
He's so good. I mean, on Ukraine, there's you and there's him, and there's very, very, very few others who are nearly as good on that topic. And I've really sacrificed this entire year of Robert Perry interviews over, you know, I mean, what he wrote was really dumb about how mean libertarians are, but I shouldn't have responded at all. Who cares? That's not what his specialty or whatever. I should have just ignored it. But instead, I picked a fight and burned a bridge where I shouldn't have. Stupid. But
well, anyway. I don't think it's really burnt.
I do still read him every day. Yeah.
You know, well, the thing is, you know, he's the quintessential investigative journalist. And if anyone were reading consortiumnews.com 10 days ago, they already knew that a deal had been worked out with Damascus, with Bashar al-Assad, evil incarnate. Please don't shoot our planes down if we start targeting your enemy, ISIL or ISIS or whatever you want to call it. And lo and behold, a week later, we have strikes on Syria, and the Syrians are crowing about the pre-coordination of these strikes with the U.S. So, right. You know,
that's true. We covered that on this show, and it was a single source story. And I said at the time, but you know what? It may be a single source, but it's Robert Perry's judgment, too. And I think you can put a lot on that. And I think we'll see this play out to be true, although it doesn't really still answer the question. And I wonder whether you would try to answer the question. Do you know yet? Of whether they've really decided to switch back to Assad. You know, like Jonathan Landay, for example, thinks, oh, come on, regime change against Assad, that's 2 years ago. They know now that that's over and that ISIS is the threat. And so maybe they'll get back to dealing with Assad some other time, but certainly for now, you know, whatever. And then on the other side, there are still quite a few commentators who think that, in a way, intervention against ISIS amounts to just a pretext for eventually getting into a fight with Assad. As long as we're bombing in Syria, how long before a Qatari jet hits an Assad target or something happens and it ends up being a full regime change?
Well, that's what the neocons want, of course, and that's what the Israelis want. And so to the degree that they're still running our policy, I'd have to say that will probably happen. The important thing is to put yourself in Bashar al-Assad's seat there. Now, if I were Bashar al-Assad, I would have great, great qualms about creating a precedent where the United States or anybody else can target places in my country. I'm virtually sure that Bashar al-Assad fully expects that once ISIL is done away with, he'll be the next target. Only problem is he knows that ISIL is not going to be done away with anytime, probably in his lifetime, because ISIL is a factor, is a result of U.S. policy, pure and simple. U.S. policy is so dumb that it'll keep on bombing and creating longer, longer lines at the recruitment centers for ISIL, for ISIS, for al-Nusra, and, if there is such a thing, for Khorasan as well.
Yeah, and whoever comes next, I saw a tweet yesterday in all caps that said, what if ISIS are the moderates? Meaning, you know, who knows what comes next? Zarqawi, as brutal as he was, he could never get his act together the way that this guy Bakr Baghdadi has. So who does know what comes after him, you know?
Well, you know, the moderates. I repeated for you the sequence of events in late August, early September of last year when Obama, thank goodness, changed his mind. Kerry wouldn't stop. He appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and they voted 10-8 for war on Syria. Kerry said, we have to get him, we have to get him, we have to get him. And besides, the good guys in Syria, the moderates, are gaining the upper hand. Now, there wasn't anyone in the U.S. government that believed that. Right. I don't think Kerry believed it either.
Well, and that was the point where he and Kerry, McCain agreed that, oh, yeah, no, the vast majority of them are secular and moderate. And that was where Putin called him a liar. And everyone said, oh, my God, what a breach of protocol for him to use the L word, but they didn't focus on what was the dispute. And the dispute was, come on, everybody knew that this war had belonged to al-Nusra from the very beginning. The vast majority of the rebels were secular moderates. I mean, come on. Who did Kerry even believe that? I guess so. I mean, if he was just being briefed by Elizabeth O. Baggy and whoever else, you know, Fred and Kimberly Kagan send over. I don't know.
Well, I think, Scott, the trick is in the pastel ties. If you have 10 pastel ties that you can kind of rotate, this gives you a certain savoir-faire and a certain what the Germans call format, and you can begin to believe your lies if you look in the mirror. Now, what happened there was, you're right, Putin called this guy a liar, and what he actually said was, quote, "It is very sad seeing the Secretary of State tell lies because he knows he is lying, and this is particularly sad," end quote. As you say, Scott, that's the, well, in my experience, that's the only time I've seen a Russian president or a premier or a first party secretary call the U.S. foreign or U.S. Secretary of State a liar. And it was because he was a liar, and it's because he was lying about moderates, and he was also lying about chemical weapons, which he attributed to Bashar al-Assad, and which I'm convinced, partly due to the good work, detective work of Bob Perry, that it was the moderate rebels, the ones that could make sarin all by themselves, and that explains why the sarin was not the same as was in Syrian government stocks.
Well, it was al-Nusra, I think, was what Perry agreed with Hirsch, that it was al-Nusra who, I don't know if they count as the moderates now or not, but those are the guys who are sworn in allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, and they do suicide attacks and prisoner beheadings and are damn near as bad as ISIS in their methods, if not exactly. I don't think that they said it was the FSA, but I guess, you know, maybe.
No, you're right.
They do work together, you know, that's the whole thing is, it's, they're all basically jihadists over there fighting.
I don't think there is an FSA, and I think it's run out of Langley, and there are a couple of people maybe in Paris running the thing. But yeah, the interesting thing is that they get away with all this stuff. And, you know, when people in college say to me, "Well, all right, McGovern, you're so smart. How are you going to defeat terrorists?" And, you know, I give them that malaria analogy, which I think I've said on your show before, that you drain the swamp. You drain the swamp of legitimate grievances that all these people who are oppressed by dictators we support and who are oppressed by Israelis without whom, who without us could not do the kinds they think in Gaza, that's going to continue forever unless we change our policy. It's getting worse, not better. Anybody can see that. So unless you subscribe, and I'm beginning to think maybe this is right, if you ask cui bono, you know, who profits from this endless supply of terrorists? Well, the people that make the weapons, people that sell the weapons, people that profiteer on the weapons. Look what happened. We armed four Iraqi divisions with the latest arms, tanks, and everything else. And when ISIS and the Peshmerga, when they started to shoot at them in northern Iraq, they ran away. And so what happened? Oh, they left the tanks and all those self-propelled artillery. They left them behind. So what did the U.S. have to do? Oh, we have to destroy the weapons so that ISIL can't get the weapons. Great, great cycle here. We destroy the vessels, then we sell more weapons. And man, is this a great country or not for the arms merchants, for the people that Dwight Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex? Now it's the military-industrial congressional complex. And we have to get out in the street and make sure that we make a statement saying, look, we've had enough of this stuff. Stop creating terrorists. Who needs them? And stop deceiving us in thinking that these people come out of the womb hardwired to hate Americans. They hate Americans because of our policies. The sooner we recognize that, the better off we'll be. We'll be able to change the policies, diminish our support for Israel, and you know, have a fair chance of being being welcomed rather than hated in that part of the world.
All right. Thanks very much, Ray. I've kept you way over time here. I really do appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Scott.
Thanks again. That's Ray McGovern, everybody. He's a former CIA analyst, a veteran intelligence professional for Sanity, writes at Consortium News and RayMcGovern.com. You can read about him at antiwar.com/blog right now. Ray McGovern triumphs over State Department. And I want to pick up on that last point. Well, the last two. First of all, American foreign policy as a Bill Hicks joke. You can't oversimplify it anymore. It's right down to the comedy routine where we're exactly going and bombing Iraq just to bomb the weapons that we gave them last time with the new stuff. It's a nightmare come true. And then the other thing is what he said about they hate us for our foreign policy. You may have seen the president on 60 Minutes last night. I mentioned it before. One of the things I didn't get to talk about in that speech is where he refers to these guys, the Islamic State guys, as, you know, being, they're so radical that they kill people simply for having a different religion than them. And so that makes them such a radical strain of crazy that we've got to be killed. But of course, that denies all responsibility on the Americans. Because it's as simple as this. Yeah, these guys are religious freaks and the very worst right-wing reactionary, you know, live according to the letter of the holy book, the way I say it reads, kind of a way that you could have. But why does anybody take them seriously at all? Why are they leading anything at all? Because the people who are the most hardcore in their beliefs are also the most hardcore in the belief that they have to join up the fight to defend Islam from foreign intervention. And the foreign intervention, that's us. That's USA. And I was going to say to Ray that don't support revolutions either. Here we're supporting dictatorships, but also we're supporting jihadists overthrowing some dictators. Assad used to torture people for Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. And you know, so now we turn on him. We shouldn't be doing either. And we shouldn't be turning back to him now. We should just be getting the hell out of there and leaving everybody alone and letting whichever brand of tyranny they suffer under not be our fault, at least. And then if we really want a reformation and an enlightenment era in the Middle East, in our information age, it's the perfect time for it. It's almost irresistible. If they could only have peace over there for a minute. So yeah, of course it's the worst of the Salafists who are willing to die in a suicide attack. But that doesn't mean that they're motivated simply by they can't stand what you believe. It's what you done. And in fact, you know what? Somebody sent me a link and reminded me to watch all, because I only watched the first half, because it came out in four segments, and then I forgot about it. But it's the Vice News documentary about ISIS. And they're interviewing this guy, and he's a religious kook, and he's saying, God willing, we're going to kill all the infidels, and we're going to kill all the unbelievers, and we're going to kill all the takfiris, or what does he call them? Whatever. And then, but why? And then he says, because of all the women and the children. And he starts crying his eyes out. Not lying. Not like faking out of religious fervor. But thinking about women and children that he knows that are dead. And he starts talking about how the unbelievers are going to pay for what they've done. And this is the worst of the ISIS kooks. This is the guy driving the proselytizer van around, beating everybody over the head with this crap. And what's he beating them over the head with? The book? No. American foreign policy. You know, all those murders.